Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with a special interview with Bert Maverick Gonzalez, a police officer who's done a ton of training, really an authority on all things safety. So we're going to talk to him today and look forward to this conversation. We are thrilled today to be joined by Bert Maverick Gonzalez, who is a 37-year veteran with the Miami-Dade Police Department. Not only has he done patrol, he's also worked in narcotics, airport, port security, crime scene investigation, and he became a national leader in a lot of training after 9/11. Has trained over 25,000 officers in a variety of areas, which we'll get into today. A recipient of the Bronze Medal of Valor and 2 life-saving awards. He has earned over 60 commendations throughout his career. He's also the author of The Real Greatest Show on Earth, by Bert Maverick, Sergeant Maverick Gonzalez. Bert, thanks for hanging out with us and coming on to talk to us today.
Thank you, Jamie, for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we talked some before we went on the air, and I had been emailing back and forth as well about what to dive into because the breadth of your experience is so vast. I guess to start off, how did you get interested in law enforcement to begin with?
Well, after I moved to Miami, my family came down from Southern New York State in 79. I was a senior in high school, so I stayed to finish my senior year. And then I started college in Western Connecticut State. Shortly after that, I followed my family to Miami. And then it turned out that my parents' direct backyard neighbor was a sergeant with Metro-Dade Police. Okay. So at the time, 1980, we were called Metro-Dade, not Miami-Dade. Something us now old timers, you know, dinosaurs, we hold on to. We prefer the name Metro instead of Miami-Dade. Because when the name changed, it made it sound like the college down here, Miami-Dade College.
Right, right.
So I got to know him very well. And then I started having some interactions with Metro Police. When I came down, I just jumped in and I worked security, private security for a little while. Had to call the police on several occasions. And then later on, as an Eckerd Drugs assistant manager, I was in the store one day. And now this is 1981. We were at the time of the Cocaine Cowboys.
Yep.
And I was in the back room on a break, sitting just inside the doors, and I heard something hitting the outside of that wall, and I heard a crashing glass sound. Well, I came out to see what it was, and some bad guy drug dealers tried to hit another bad guy drug dealer that was walking into our store. They lit him up with an automatic weapon, and they came into the store and hit the store, you know, inside of the store.
Jeez.
So then Metro Police had to respond. Metro Fire had to respond. And I got to see how they worked, and it just started to I don't want to say wear on me, but it started to ingrain in me the fact that I either wanted to be a police officer or a firefighter.
Okay.
So I, in 1982, while I was working for a small credit and collections company, I applied to both Metro Police and Metro Fire. And then in January of 83, the fire department called me for my final interview. And the hiring chief said, hey, we're going to put you in a fire college class, next class, which was maybe a month away. Mm-hmm. I said, great. Okay. You know, fire service. And then 2 weeks later, my background investigator for Metro Police called me and goes, you're starting the academy February 8th. And okay. I said, okay, great. Because I wanted to be a police officer more than I wanted to be a firefighter.
Okay.
Either one would have worked for me. I have the same mentality as, you know, for both. But more desire to be a cop. And that's when I started the academy. And I came out during the height of the cocaine cowboy era. And then just, you know, got immersed in it with all my other colleagues that, you know, were getting hired at the time.
Yeah, I would imagine in Dade County area that there's no shortage of circumstances to find yourself in where you need law enforcement. So you worked in a variety of different areas. Did you have a favorite area, whether that was port security, narcotics, crime scene investigation, while you were still an officer? Was there a particular area that you're like, yeah, I want to do more of this?
As a young officer, it was patrol. And then each one of our districts has its own detective bureau, and contained within that detective bureau is a crime suppression team. So it's a quasi, sometimes uniform, mostly plainclothes, surveillance type squad that you go out and you target the areas like for robberies and burglaries and auto thefts, and you do street level narcotics. So that was my involvement with narcotics. We have a large narcotics bureau, as you can imagine, right? Miami-Dade, Metro-Dade back then, and the City of Miami Police both had extensive narcotics bureaus. So if we were to get involved in something more than street level, we would come across something large. We would bring in the narcotics bureau and they would take over because they worked with the DEA as well. One case in point, the crime suppression team, we were working driveway robberies. And what that was, this is November, December of 85. People were being followed home from the more ritzy stores like Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus. And at the time here, Burdine's, which is now Macy's. Mm-hmm. And they drive nice cars and they're driving home to an area that is very affluent. And they would get robbed in their driveways, right? To just pull up, rob them, hit them, whatever, steal their jewelry, whatever they had on, and flee. So we were assigned to work that. So a lot of surveillance stuff. And then one night, one of the extra officers we hired from Uniform Patrol to supplement our squad, because we needed a lot of guys. We only had like six guys on our squad. We needed at least double that for this detail. We came across two guys one evening that were at the front door of the house. One of them was looking in the picture window on the side. And I turned to Mark, you know, and it was dark. It was, it was December. So the time had changed. So at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, it's dark already. We looked at it. It was very suspicious. Two guys. One of them was holding a package. We drove down. We turned around. We came back. They were gone. Okay, so red flags are going up. We pulled down the street. We backed into a driveway. I knocked on the door, and I badged the resident, and I said, hey, we're Metro Police. We're watching a house right over here. I don't want you to call the police on us, okay? Because mm-hmm. We didn't want any uniformed cars to blow our surveillance. We called in the rest of the squad, and Joe from the squad, who was our talker, right? He was very smooth at talking. He went to the front door with one of the guys, and Mark and I went around the back and we just posted up. He's talking to the woman that answered the door and he's asking her, well, there were two guys here at the front door. No, there was nobody here. So then he relays that to us around the back. And I said, Joe, we're staring at the two guys sitting in the Florida room on the couch with the children. Okay, those are the two guys that we saw at the front door. So, you know, something's wrong. Joe, using his gift of gab, talked his way in. We talked to the woman. We detained the two guys. And she gave us a consent to search the house. We started searching. We found in one of the rooms in the closet suitcases with coffee grounds in them. We found a garbage bag, which eventually we counted $1,300,000 in cash. There was a ledger book on a table that went to the DEA, and they broke the code. And we found some Mac 11 machine guns. And then when we got into the attic, we found 208 kilos of cocaine.
Wow.
And at that time, it was the largest seizure in Dade County.
Yeah, I was gonna. What year was this?
The end of 85.
Okay.
Okay. So the DEA broke the code, and that came back to a real estate office in Miami, Milan, Italy, and Colombia. So it was a triangle. And they had set up a Colombian family with children to live in this house to make it look like someone was just living there. But that's where they were funneling things out of. The two guys were drug dealers, you know, traffickers. And for that, we brought in narcotics. Narcotics brought in a DEA. And, you know, we had turned it over to narcotics because it was such a big seizure. It wasn't street level anymore. Fast forward a little bit, you go in time, and now we, you know, it's brought in by the tonnage. You know, so at the time, you know, that was a big deal for us. And I can tell you that counting $1,300,000 in cash takes a very long time.
I can't imagine.
You got to be accurate.
Yeah. And again, that's 1985. So if you, the value of that would be vastly higher now, of course.
So that was my involvement as far as narcotics goes. Later on, I was transferred to another station after having a few difficulties with a supervisor. And, you know, that's not uncommon in police work.
Sure.
You know, when you're vocal, you speak out. So they sometimes don't like that, you know. So I became a field training officer in my new district, and I started training rookies, and I enjoyed it. I wasn't, you know, much more than 4.5 years on the job myself, but at the time we had to grow so much. We were hiring so many cops, us in the city of Miami, that you didn't have a pool of 10 to 15 year veteran officers to train the rookies. So with 3 years on, you had a lot of experience already. And then you know, pay it forward and start training the new guys coming out of the academy. So I did that for a while as well. So, you know, that's how I got started in training.
And you've trained in the areas of crisis intervention, active shooter response, major scene management, tactical driving, crowd control. So it seems like you were able to touch pretty much all the big, areas of responsibility in law enforcement. And with all that expertise, you've written a book. Again, The Greatest Show on Earth by Burt Maverick Gonzalez, which you kind of opened the door behind the scenes for police work. What was your motivation? Why did you want to write this book?
During our travels, and this is not unique to me, so everything I talk about in the book, it's not me that I did all these things. When let's qualify some of the statements. When I say I've trained 25,000 officers, that's a rough estimate over the whole period of time. But as a member of a cadre training committees, where we train the officers. And the biggest one is the Mobile Field Force Training Committee. That's what we call crowd control down here.
Right.
So that's a big committee that I joined after I got promoted in 98. And I spent 18 years on that committee. And every spring, which we called our Mobile Field Force training season, because it's spring down here and it's not quite so hot. As it is during the summer, because you got to wear a lot of gear, you know, the riot gear and all that. And we're putting them through their paces out in the field and we're fighting with them, you know, to simulate violent crowds. And I instituted first throwing tennis balls at them. I'm a tennis player, so I would bring my tennis balls to simulate rocks and bottles.
Yeah.
And it worked fine, but when you have a shield, the tennis ball bounces off and boom, and we're chasing tennis balls all over the place. So then I went to Burger King and I asked them for those little plastic balls in the playgrounds.
Yeah.
And I was able to get a few hundred from one of the local Burger Kings. I told them who I was, what I was doing. So I cut them open. I filled them about 3/4 with sand and put duct tape on them. And then we threw those and then it would hit the shield and just fall on the ground. But it also worked well that if the officer didn't properly utilize the shield and his protective gear and he got hit with it, it hurts. Mm-hmm. So pretend it's a real rock or a bottle, you know. So, but every year we saw about 2,000 officers. You know, we just keep retraining our people every year to keep them proficient in crowd control. So when you start adding those numbers up over 18 years, you can see where that part of that 25,000 comes into play. And then I was a driving instructor after my first year on the job. Driving is a passion of mine, so I put in to become a driving instructor, and they accepted me. And for 36 of my 37 years, on and off, mm-hmm. not all the time, I taught driving. And then later as a sergeant, I got heavily involved in the crisis intervention team program and training officers to deal with the mentally ill. Major scene management, I was part of a really great group started by Lieutenant Raul Chuy Martinez, who I was my supervisor in crime scene for a little bit, but then the director came to him and said, we are really lacking good supervision out on the street. We need to train our sergeants and lieutenants to handle crises better than what we're doing. And he put together that group along with guys from the Field Force Committee, because we're all used to training a lot of people in, you know, volatile situations. And I did that for a long time with him and the other guys, just getting sergeants and lieutenants proficient in handling crises out on the street, major scenes, no matter what it is, from a simple, you know, maybe a car crash fatality to a hazmat situation, active shooter, a robbery, a police-involved shooting, an officer shot, crowd situation, and then part. As part of the Mobile Field Force Committee, we started doing active shooter training because of the amount of incidents that were happening around the country, and we had to train our personnel how to respond to that. Because the old way of responding to active shooter, and this is so important that I have a dedicated chapter in my book on it, the truths and myths about police response and training to active shooter. So we had to teach the guys, you're the first on scene. You're not going to make a perimeter like they did in Columbine and wait for SWAT. Mm-hmm. You need to go in and you need to neutralize the threat, because every gunshot is a child or a person dying. So that we did for quite a few years. And that's really intense training, because you're going in harm's way and everybody knows it. And you've got to try to overcome that fear of knowing you're going to go confront some bad guys with some really serious weapons. So it's my experience and training has been with a large group of people most of the time and working together. So I just want to make it clear, it's not me alone.
Sure.
I'm not
sure.
Unique. So with the book, during my travels, a lot of the people we encounter will say, hey, with everything you've seen and done, you ought to write a book. Right? I heard that a lot during my career. From people on patrol, you know, I could go into their house to handle a call, or, you know, I got them on a crash or whatever the case is. So in 2018, I started giving it some serious thought. And I said, you know, let me see if I can do this. I've been writing reports for 15 years as an officer, incident reports, arrest forms, crashes, you know, all that kind of stuff. While it's not a book, it's still writing. And then as a sergeant, I had all the administrative reports that I had to write. And then the memos explaining the actions of one of my officers, or, you know, something like that. And you're always telling a story when you're writing these things, especially a use of force report. If the guys got into a fight with somebody, then as a sergeant, then I got to do a use of force report. So I said, all right, let me do this. Let me give it a try. And I started thinking about what I wanted the book to be about. I don't read fiction. I've read very few fiction novels in my life. The only one that I really remember and enjoyed was Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy.
Yep. Okay.
Which kind of like what Russia is doing now by spreading out into Ukraine again, right?
Right.
And I'm a history buff, especially war history. So I like nonfiction historical events. And then I put together a list of things I wanted to write about. And in order to do this, it had to be the truth, the unfiltered truth about policing in America. What I wrote in the book is what happens every day on the streets of the US involving the police. It's unfiltered. It's the good, the bad, and the ugly. I praise us. I throw us under the bus when I need to. And the different chapters, so since the title, The Real Greatest Show on Earth, because we consider what we do out here as a circus. And we're the ringmasters.
Yeah.
Right? So that's why the title, you know, I came up with that title because it's, you know, like the Ringling Brothers Circus. But this is real. This is not, you know, fiction or fake or TV stuff. And that's how that came about. So, and my chapters, I don't call them chapters. They're called acts, like act one, act two. Mm-hmm. And the subchapters are scenes, like a theatrical scene. So I maintain that theme throughout the book. So I start off with, why would someone want to become a police officer, right? You know, why does someone want to become a teacher or whatever? And I kind of get into that with my own story. And then I take the readers through what the academy is like, the hiring process and then the academy. And the academy was 5 months. And there's, you know, all the ups and downs, the physical training, the book work that you have to do, and, you know, pass or fail. And when you graduate, what happens after a cadet graduates? A lot of people really don't know. You get assigned to a district or some departments, a precinct or whatever they call it. And you ride with a field training officer that's going to show you the ropes now, right? Everything you learn in the academy is going to be put into practical application. And in Florida, the field training and evaluation program is when you come out of the academy, you get 3 field training officers, 1 month on each shift, mm-hmm. days, afternoons, midnights. And how that is, and, you know, what you go through with the 3 different officers of varying experiences and what you can learn from them, the good and the bad, mm-hmm. right? Because not all of them are good. You know, everybody has a personality. So you've got to learn, okay, you're the new guy and you've got to learn to get along and absorb what you can. And then you're out on your own and all the things that come with being out on your own. And I have chapters on running lights and sirens, what that's like, use of force, relationships, police and relationships, because we're not very good at them most of the time. I'm your typical veteran from my time where I'm married 3 times, you know, and most of us are, you know, at least a couple of times. I have a chapter on internal affairs, which is important. Even though cops don't really like internal affairs, it's very necessary. The police that police the police. Right. You got to have that. The administration. My chapter on the administration is called The Brass, The Good, The Bad, The Idiotic, and The Hypocritical, or The Hypocritical and The Idiotic. And you get, you know, for cops, and I think firefighters as well, but more so for cops and probably the military, your supervisor can make or break your work experience. And in all walks of life, the number one reason people leave their job is because of their boss.
Right.
For a larger department like mine, you can put in for a transfer. But we also change shifts every 4 months. We bid according to our seniority, and then maybe you don't have that sergeant again. You don't have to leave the district you're in. But if you had a really good sergeant, and I've had plenty of really great sergeants and lieutenants, work life is really good. When you have piss poor ones, work life is really bad. You know, and I have a story in the book about blowing off steam because our sergeant was so bad and treated us so badly. And I'll just say an egg fight was involved.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was sorely needed to get rid of that stress.
Yeah.
I have chapters on millennials, the next generation. So I'm a Trekkie. Mm-hmm. I love Star Trek. So I also use a lot of Star Trek references and Star Wars references. I'll refer to the young officers as the young Jedi Knights, mm-hmm. you know, that we're training and stuff. And the difference between you know, the millennials, the next generation is the name of that chapter. The difference between their generation and our generation and how they are very tech savvy when we're not. You know, I had a notepad and a pen. And that's the way I did it. Everything's computerized now. And even at the tail end of my career, when I was assigned a laptop and then all the calls would get dispatched over the laptop, I never used it. And fortunately, I was a sergeant already for a long time. So the dispatcher would say, well, I sent the call to your MCU, your mobile computing unit. That's what they called the laptop. And I would tell her negative, give it to me over the air. And she can't argue with me because, I'm the supervisor. And I had a notepad, a clip to my dashboard, and I would do it old school and write it down. And what the young kids today don't realize is that when you write something down, it's a memory tool.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? And then since I have the clipboard right in front of me, I had my green and white, as we call it, the Miami-Dade police cars. They were old, real green and whites, partially green, partially white. And then they went to a stripe job because it was cheaper, right? Mm-hmm. Just putting stripes on a white car. And now it's been transitioning back to green and white that we love, we're very proud of. You know, LA has the black and whites,
Right, right.
But what the young guys don't understand is that all these things are memory tools, but they're so locked into the laptop. And then you have to look at that damn thing while you're driving, especially running lights and sirens, which is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. You've got to focus on what you're doing. Now, where are you guys located?
We're in Kentucky.
Okay. Bigger, one of the bigger cities?
No, we're just south of Lexington. So we spend a lot of time in Lexington and Louisville, which Lexington's really not that big, but Louisville, yes.
Okay. A lot of traffic?
Oh, yeah, a ton.
Okay.
Terrible.
So Miami-Dade County, of course, huge metropolitan area. It's very spread out. Lots of traffic, lots of people, and more people coming in all the time. You're running lights and sirens. You've got to be focused on what's going on in front of you instead of looking at the damn computer, mm-hmm. right? You forgot the address already, that you're going to. Whatever the case is, whatever's happening, you hear it. And my wife does this with me all the time. She'll give me an address of someplace we're going. Boom, it's in here. Mm-hmm. I don't need her to tell me again. Because of so many years of repetition, right, that I memorized the address right away. The young guys aren't really doing that. They are much better with, because everything's computerized, they're much better with this stuff, writing reports and arrest forms and all kinds of stuff and running background checks on people. I didn't know how to do that. I pick up the microphone, I tell the dispatcher, check this driver's license or this guy for me.
Yeah.
That's the only way we could do it back then. Laptops and computers didn't exist. Not for us anyway. So that's really the crux of the book as a how-to guide for civilians, the media, the public, politicians. I get into politics in the book because police are directly affected by the politicians that they serve. And whatever policies they may, lay down makes our lives either our jobs either easier, not always the case, not usually the case. It makes it worse. It makes it harder for us.
Yeah.
With Jessica from ThinkAmerican.News, I've written a whole bunch of op-eds for her. And my latest one is on the Chicago refusal to Chicago PD refusal to respond as backup to ICE on that incident on October 4th.
Right.
And I was so upset by that while I was on vacation in North Carolina, I took my laptop with me knowing that my wife and I were going to have some downtime at the cabin, that I was going to write this article. You never, ever, ever not back up a fellow officer. It's just not done.
Yeah.
But that's because of the politicians' policies in Chicago. That never would have happened here, and I'll tell you why. We have a little clause in our manual that says you do not have to follow an order if it's illegal or immoral. Not backing up other officers is at the very least immoral and unethical. I would venture to say it crosses over into the malfeasance and illegal. And I like to see some people go to jail for this, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
Right.
So the book is about all those things completely unfiltered so the public can understand who we are, why we do things the way we do, especially when it comes to use of force. Why do police engage? Why do they have to beat somebody into submission? Sometimes have to shoot them, use tasers, whatever the case is, you know, why? Mm-hmm. I explain all those things. I have a chapter on domestics, because that's the single most dangerous call a police officer responds to. So these are the important things, the highlights of the career. I also have a chapter on court, going to court, which I call another circus. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever been in a criminal court or a traffic court, it really is a circus.
It's wild, yeah.
You know? And the poor bastard that doesn't have a lot of money, that can't afford an attorney, usually gets steamrolled in court. Where the guy with a lot of money is going to have the best lawyers, and they're going to play the games. Mm-hmm. You know, and delay and delay and delay and... You know, but all these things are part of our lives. And I felt it was important to cover those things.
Yeah. What I love most about it is the comprehensive piece of, you mentioned throwing yourselves under the bus. Like, it's not all, this is everything we do great. Like, there are problems, and you're also crossing generations and changes over time. And I mean, obviously, in recent years, a big change over time is having body cams. And
yes,
I've never seen a body cam video to show how well an officer handled something. We only get to see the ones where things go or appear to go poorly. And a lot of it are those instances of force there. So I think it would help the public greatly to know what are officers trained on with use of force, when it, why are they doing those things? So can you just give us maybe a preview of that from the book?
Sure. So our force now, in my chapter on police and politics called Oil and Water, I get into some of the misconceptions about us. And one of the things that annoys the hell out of me and my colleagues, ours is the only profession that you hear when people talk about us, usually in the media and politicians, that 99% of all police officers are good. I'm sick and tired of hearing that. Do you ever hear that about any other vocation in our society?
No.
You don't hear it about firefighters.
Yeah.
You don't hear it about teachers. You certainly don't hear it about politicians. Okay.
Yeah.
You don't hear it about lawyers, but that's the way we're described. Because when you see a use of force incident and it looks bad. Now, here's a question that I always ask, so I want your honest answer. When you see a use of force incident on the TV news, does it look ugly?
Always.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. It always does. Force is ugly.
Mm-hmm.
You're hurting somebody. Okay. How did they get there? So before everybody starts doing this Olympic sport, as we call it, jumping to conclusions.
Right.
Let's peel back the layers of this onion and find out why that officer or those officers reached that level of force, from simple grabbing and handcuffing all the way up to deadly force and possibly firearm usage. Our force is directly proportionate to the level of resistance by the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jamie, are you married?
I am.
Okay, so you're living here in Miami-Dade County, and you and your wife have an argument that reached certain level that police were called, right? Started getting a bit violent, loud and violent. We respond to your house. We respond minimum two officers. That's a two-man call.
Okay.
Any domestic's a two-man call. Probably more, depending on the level of violence or how the call came in from a family member, a neighbor, one of you yourselves called the police. We determine, and this is the norm, this is the higher percentage. You hit your wife.
Okay.
We determine domestic battery. Jamie's going to jail today. But Jamie doesn't want to go to jail today.
Right.
And we tell him, Mr. Boggs, turn around, put your hands behind your back. You're under arrest for domestic battery.
Okay.
You say, F you. No, I'm not going. And we say, F you. Yes, you are. Okay.
Sure.
Now we go to put hands on you and you start fighting us. Your level of resistance is more from just pulling your arms away, you know, like this, and we're trying to grab you, to where now you're swinging on us, and we just go from 0 to 100% in a few seconds or 30 seconds, and now it's an all-out, knockdown, drag-out fight. We have to take you into custody. The law says that we can use the force necessary to make the arrest. From simple grabbing and handcuffing all the way up to deadly force. Mm-hmm. The determination has been made that Mr. Boggs is going to jail. That's it, end of story. There is no arguing.
Right.
You're not going to dispute it here on the scene. You have court for that later on. Right now, you must comply with our orders to submit to our arrest. You want to fight. So we're going to keep fighting until you've submitted. That could mean that you're going to get hurt from strikes with hands, strikes with a baton. A weapon of opportunity could have been the flashlight we had in our hand. Now, you know, all the guys carried these little short flashlights that are super bright. But we had 3-cell flashlights back in the day, you know, made out of aircraft aluminum.
Yeah.
It makes a great weapon, right? And I've had to use it in that way because I was in the middle of a knockdown, drag-out fight, and I happened to have it in my hand. I'm allowed to do that. The law says I can do that until you're taken into custody. Suppose now you're trying to grab our gun, which happens in many, many fights. Every single fight that a police officer is involved in, there's at least one gun involved. His.
Mm-hmm.
Bad guys will try to get that gun from us. The development of retention holsters, you know, started in the 80s to retain that weapon, and gun retention training to keep it in your holster when they're trying to get it. If you are going for my gun, that means it's deadly force. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do if you get my gun? You're going to hold it up and go, well, Sergeant Gonzalez, look, oh, you've got a nice looking gun here. No, you're going to shoot me with my own gun. And in 1983, when I graduated the academy, 50% of all officers shot in the U.S. were shot with their own weapon. Mm. It was a problem.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's way down low now because of the retention holsters and because of the training. And the way that we interact with people, you know, I'm going to keep you at least 3 feet away from me when I'm interacting with you. You know, it's a, you know, the 3-foot world, as soldiers call it, right?
Right.
Same thing for police. Exact same thing. We're going to keep you at bay. Because it gives us reaction time if you try to go for a gun. But you try to go for my gun, you're going to get seriously hurt. You're going to go to the hospital before you go to jail.
Yeah.
And there's many cases where you go to the morgue instead. We are authorized to do that. Mm-hmm. So you're under arrest for domestic battery. You decide to fight us. We're going to keep escalating depending on your level of resistance until you are in custody. Of course, if we hurt you, we call fire rescue. They either transport you or they clean you up, and then we transport you to the hospital before you go to the jail. Those are the things you don't get to see on the videos that the news puts out,
right,
or people on social media. How did it happen? How did it start? And the biggest example of that, which I used in the book, is the Rodney King incident.
Mm-hmm.
NBC edited that video to show us only what they wanted us to see, which was the baton beating at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Not the female trooper being beaten up on the hood of her own patrol car by Rodney King, and then the chase. What we saw was at the end. Now, I can tell you this. At the end, when you saw the five or six officers hitting King with the baton, with batons, and there was a circle of officers around them between LAPD and LA County Sheriff and probably some other municipalities in there. While he was still standing and they were hitting him, they were completely justified in what they were doing. When he went down on a knee, why do you continue doing it? Now, they were acquitted in state court because they followed department procedure and state law at the time. They were found guilty or civilly liable in federal civil rights court. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that, let me put you in that situation. We know you don't have a weapon. We're not going to stand in a circle and hit you with batons. You have the football. It's going to be a scrum. We're just going to jump on you. And we're going to take you down with bodies and take you into custody. There's no need to go that far. Why? You know, they kept hitting him and hitting him and hitting him.
Right.
No, down here in Florida, especially South Florida, and it doesn't matter what department you work for. We all have the same mentality, the same training. We're taking you down. All of us, we're just jumping on you. Mm-hmm. You can't win against all of us. Now, we're going to get scraped. We're going to get bruised. We're going to get cut, you know, all that. And that happens all the time in every fight. But we're not going to sit around and beat you senselessly, you know, for that period of time. That was so bad.
Yeah.
You know, and I know maybe some of the, you know, the guys from that era, and if they hear your podcast, and I've said it on other podcasts before, and I, you know, I wrote about it in the book. Mm-hmm. I don't care that you may be upset with me. You guys could have just gang tackled them and it would have been over and there would have been no controversy. But as it was, there was controversy, you know, great outrage. And he got $56 million in civil court, $1 million for each baton strike.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, and we learned from our own lessons here back in the late 70s with the McDuffie riots, mm-hmm. where some of our own officers beat a motorcyclist to death, and that prompted the 1980 riots when they were acquitted. What can I say? You know, bad apples, you know, and there. So that's the unfiltered part of what I'm talking about.
Some questions that, I mean, I feel like people pose often is what are the limitations? Because a lot of what we see in these videos that's that is alleged to cause long-term harm or maybe some holds that you have people in or positions that they're held in, are there prohibited holds or positions to hold people in?
Yes. So you're alluding to Minnesota, Minneapolis, George Floyd.
Yes. That's the probably the most well-known one. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So George Floyd is the Rodney King of our time now, you know, present day, so to speak. I can tell you, Jamie, that I have never been trained to sit with my knee on some guy's neck for 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay. We don't do that. If it's a fight, we are going to restrain you and use any means necessary to take you into custody. Once you're handcuffed, right, and we control these, mm-hmm. you control the hands can't kill you. That's the way it is for us. You control the hands, which are what's used to kill a police officer. Once we have you controlled, and then sometimes tying up your feet as well, because we've had many windows kicked out in the cars, so we have leg straps to tie your feet, you know, so you can't kick a window out. Mm-hmm. It's over. Once that's done, it's over. Now, if I was the sergeant of those guys and I rolled up on that scene, I would have said, number one, what the hell are you guys doing? Get him in the car and get him out of here. Sitting there with his knee on his neck. No, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. That is so far outside of the way we're trained. At least, you know, the majority of cops that I know, especially in Florida. My understanding was that they were actually trained to do that. And that's why the city of Minneapolis paid out $27 million or $26 million, you know, in a settlement. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to tell me you're following department policy, really? To hold your neck on a guy for that long?
Yeah.
See, I have to call bullshit on that. We don't understand that. Now, you have all kinds of holds to be able to take somebody into custody. I'm going to give you the most controversial one, which the media refers to as the chokehold. It's not a chokehold. It's called an applied carotid triangular restraint. It's a fancy term for what everybody knows if you watch professional wrestling, a sleeper hold.
It's a sleeper hold, yeah.
Right? And it comes from martial arts. So what it does, by putting this and your bicep are squeezing the carotid artery. Okay? You're slowing the flow of blood to your brain. That makes you pass out temporarily. That allows us to get you into custody. As soon as we apply that, we got you controlled, we got you handcuffed, you take the pressure off the carotid artery, you wake up on your own because blood's flowing again, and it's only for a couple of seconds. A choke is when you're cutting off the airway.
Right.
We're not doing that, all right, because you're in the V of the elbow.
Right, right.
So this is not affecting your airway, but they call it a chokehold. And I had to talk about that in two different chapters in the book because so the politicians, here's a chokehold, chokehold. And the liberal politicians and the mayor of Miami-Dade County, because at the time we have an appointed director who answers to the mayor and the county commission, she prohibited the actor, as we call it. My son in his specialized unit, and my son's a sergeant on the department as well now. He was in a specialized unit that went after the worst of the worst bad guys. He's used that many, many times to take guys into custody. We've never killed anybody with it.
Yeah.
It's very effective because once you pass out, you know, once you start going out, you can't fight anymore. That's the whole point. Now, can an accident happen where you squeeze too hard or because the subject is struggling, it moves from the V in the elbow to the bone of your forearm, right? And then it could it collapse the windpipe? Yes, of course. Anything can happen. But in our experience in South Florida, especially my department, we've never seriously hurt anybody with that. We've never killed anybody. And when we apply that, that's use of force. That means a sergeant has to do a use of force report. We have to call fire rescue for the subject to get him checked out. Then we have to take him to the hospital to get him checked out. And then they go to jail. So it's really a misconception as to how we apply that technique. We recently transitioned. We were always the sheriff's office, Miami-Dade, Dade County, sheriff's office. And then in 58, it transitioned to what's called in Florida the Home Rule Charter, where Tallahassee allowed Dade County to govern itself. So they didn't have an elected sheriff anymore, but an appointed director that answered to the commission. Last year, we had an election. The public voted to have an elected sheriff in Dade County again, along with the other 66 counties in Florida that have all have elected sheriffs. So now our new sheriff, Rosie, who was an assistant director with us, she no longer answers to the mayor. So she can implement any policies she wants. Unlike a chief of police in a city, or let's say like Chicago, you answer to the mayor. You work at the pleasure of the mayor. The commissioner in New York works at the pleasure of the mayor. So now it's being reinstituted as a useful use of force tool because it really is a valuable tool for police officers. You're by yourself, especially if you can get them into that hold, you can apply it, get them to pass out, roll them over, get them handcuffed. Fight's over. You know, so yes, there's restrictions. That's a useful tool. Choking somebody out here is never permitted. Holding someone, you know, on their neck for 9 minutes, that's never permitted. We used to do something a long time ago called hog tie, where we would handcuff your hands and feet behind your back and tie your feet up, bring your knees up like this, and get them tied to your hands. So now you can't kick, you can't do anything. our medical examiner at the time found that if you're laying on your stomach like that, you can die of asphyxiation. There's some people that don't do well with that positioning. So then we had to get rid of that particular technique, which is fine.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And as time goes on, the decades go on, we evolve like everything else does, you know, and then things that may have worked before were allowed before are not allowed now. Mm-hmm. And I think for the most part, it's a good thing. Like you had mentioned the cameras.
Yeah. Yeah. I have two more questions. I don't want to take too much of your time and I don't want you to give up your entire book, but out of my personal curiosity, what are the guidelines for the discretion between a taser and a firearm in certain situations?
Okay. The taser, by Taser International, is called Axion now. They came up with a great tool. This was really to get people that are mentally ill or under the influence of drugs and alcohol to comply with police orders so you can take them into custody. Mm-hmm. So in your domestic case, we arrest you. That's an arrest. Mm-hmm. You have mental illness, and we're going to take you into protective custody and take you to a crisis receiving facility so you stop hurting yourself or self-neglecting. That's also called an arrest. Mm-hmm. We are arresting you physically, taking you against your will from this place to that place. Everything's called an arrest. The taser was designed for those instances and also for violent subjects. So what it does, and people, this is a big misconception. The taser is an electronic control device, ECD, or electronic control weapon, depending on what the agency calls it. It will shoot out two prongs. And when I'm pointing it at you, it looks just like a gun. Mm-hmm. And it's worn cross draw. Or in the early days of Taser, they were a lot of officers were carrying it on the same thigh as the firearm, and they ended up pulling the wrong weapon.
Sure.
So we strictly 100% cross-draw, so you know you're not pulling your firearm. It shoots out two darts and with 21 feet of wire. Mm-hmm. One dart goes perfectly straight. The other one goes on an angle. What you're trying to do is hit your subject with a spread pattern. The wider the spread, the longer the arc to close the circuit, and the more effective it is. Mm-hmm. It uses 50,000 volts, and I know that scares a lot of people. All that means is that's the power necessary to shoot those darts out and complete the circuit. It's actually 0.038 amps. You ever hear the saying, you know, it's not the volts that kill you, it's the amps?
Yeah.
Right. So this is very, very low amperage. But what it does, it affects the neuromuscular system of your body. It doesn't affect your heart. It doesn't affect your brain or anything like that. That's a big misconception. No one has died because of the use of the taser, even though we've had incidents where they say the police killed a guy with a taser. No, that's not the case. He had an underlying condition, okay, that ended up killing him because of the amount of exertion that they projected at the time. So the taser locks your muscles up. And when I went through taser training, we had to get tased.
Sure.
So we can feel what it's like. This way, when we go to court and we're asked in a coroner's inquest, why did you shoot that guy? Well, he had his own taser. He got my taser. And I know that if he hits me with it, I can't do anything. I'm completely immobilized. Therefore, it's deadly force against me, and I can return with deadly force. The taser locks you up, and Jamie, it hurts like you cannot believe.
Yeah.
The nickname we gave it is called Riding the Lightning.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
Because it hurts so bad. So we use that to take people into custody, and it locks them up if it hits just right.
Uh-huh.
So in your region, it gets cold. Mm-hmm. You're wearing a heavy jacket. It doesn't work on a heavy jacket. It doesn't go through. The darts have to penetrate. Mm-hmm. It works in warmer areas because people are usually in T-shirts or something very light, so it works well. But it's also not 100% accurate because you're deploying it under stress. You may miss. One of the darts may miss.
And if either misses, it doesn't work?
It doesn't work.
Okay.
And then on TV, and this drives me insane. You ever see in the TV shows or movies when someone gets shot with a handheld device, you know, they shock them and then they pass out, you know, and they kidnap them or whatever the case is. You can do that with a taser. You take the cartridge off that has the darts in it. It's got two prongs on it that you can direct stun somebody. But that only hurts. It looks like a snake bite. That only shocks the part or hurts the part that it's touching. Once you remove it, there's no more pain. Once the taser stops, there's no more pain. Every trigger pull on a taser is 5 seconds. That's one cycle. Sometimes we've got to light people up 2 and 3 cycles to get their attention and make them stop fighting. Somebody with severe mental illness, they're not feeling pain. Someone who's really drunk or on serious drugs and they got spiders crawling all over them and they're naked and sweaty and all that.
Yeah.
They're not feeling it, but that's what it was designed for. So the taser doesn't always work, and it certainly does not knock you out, make you unconscious. And the only real injuries from a taser, we are trained to remove the darts from our subject if they are in a non-vital area. So your torso, your leg, you know, fatty tissue, boom, pop them out. If we hit you in the neck or the face or something vital, the groin, you know, we take you to the emergency room and a doctor removes them. Those are the only injuries, or other than we tase you, you're locked up, you can't move. You know, we call it doing the chicken. You know, you're like this, and you fall down and hit your face because you can't, you know, protect yourself. Right. Those are the injuries from a taser. But they've never killed anybody. And we had a case here in Miami Beach where they first tried to say that the taser killed this kid, and then it was reversed because it didn't kill him. He had that underlying condition that I mentioned. And that happens with a lot of people. They don't know they have these conditions, or they're so hopped up on cocaine that it fries your system. And I actually had a kid die with my handcuffs on from cocaine psychosis, now called excited delirium. So that's how the taser really works. You know, people really don't understand that.
Yeah,
that it's a really good tool, but it doesn't always work. And if you're not conscientious, make sure you got fresh batteries in it, or your sergeant doesn't make you inspect, you know, your taser. You're supposed to test fire it every single day. And if it falls below a certain percentage on the battery, you go to the quartermaster and you get a new battery. And so it'll work. The last thing you want is when you need it, it doesn't work.
Right, right. So, are there times that tasers could be used instead of firearms and they're not? I mean, obviously you just covered several different reasons a taser might work. Clothing, distance, certain types of behavior, and several other times it wouldn't work. But are there times, could we use them more instead of firearms?
It's all situational.
Yeah.
So I'll use you again as an example. We come to your house for the domestic, or you're just a bad guy. We got a warrant for, you know, we're going to arrest you. You pull a knife. You brought a knife to a gunfight.
Right.
We all go through, and I went through a knife defense training. And the rule is 21 feet plus the length of the blade. That's the distance that you want to keep from someone with a edged weapon. A child with something sharp in their hands, a pair of scissors. And we had one of our officers light up a 7-year-old in school that had a piece of broken glass in his hand.
Yeah.
So he tased him. Well, you know what? It worked. He got a lot of shit for it.
Yeah.
And they wanted him suspended and everything. But you know what? He took that kid into custody without any injury to him, an injury to himself because he had the broken glass in his hand. And this was in a school. The kid had some mental issues. Something like that, yes. But an edged weapon is anything from a knife of any size, a kitchen knife, a screwdriver, a pair of scissors, a utility knife. That's going to do some serious damage. When officers thought that they could go up against somebody with that, and they got filleted.
Sure.
So we're not going to allow that. It all depends. So some officers may look at a woman, you know, maybe with something in her hand and say, you know, all right, she's not really a threat or whatever, and decide to deploy the taser. Now, when we do deploy the taser, the training is, if I'm deploying the taser to someone with something in their hand, an officer is standing by with their firearm already drawn, mm-hmm. in case it doesn't work. But in the case of holding a big pair of scissors or, you know, a long knife or something like that, we're not going to play with that. You know, officers have been seriously injured mm-hmm. or killed because of that. The taser isn't really meant for that.
Okay.
We're going to order you, put it down, put it down, put it down, put it down. And then you don't put it down and bad things happen. So.
That's very helpful. And I think that's part of the problem with perception and all these viral videos is people don't understand what officers are taught and B, why, because they're. A lot of these things that are happening that we see, that was necessary in that situation, but we don't always know that or have the background to see that. And I think your book and you speaking, and you have a podcast, Sergeant Maverick, the podcast, I think you're doing a lot to help educate people. So I greatly appreciate that. I have one more question before I let you go. Where did you get the name Maverick?
Everybody has it. So do you remember that supervisor I mentioned that I had problems with when I got transferred?
Yeah.
Okay. So this was March of 88. I went from Southwest District to Midwest District, and I landed on the Midnight Field Training Squad. So they were training rookies out of the academy. Mm-hmm. The sergeant that I got, Jim Slack, the absolute best supervisor I ever had. His call sign was Pappy.
Okay.
And the squad was known as the Black Sheep, from Black Sheep Squadron fame from World War II, the mm-hmm. VMF 214. But every guy and gal on the squad had a nickname from Top Gun, the movie. This was 88. Top Gun came out in 86.
Sure.
So they all had names, and it was all based on their personalities. It wasn't arbitrary. So one of my closest friends, David, whose call sign is Jester. He's always laughing and joking. He's always happy. So Jester, you know.
Makes sense.
The female in the squad, Patty, Mother Goose, just kind of fit. Mm-hmm. So for me, since I came after, you know, having some issues with a supervisor, they mm-hmm. said, so you come with having been in trouble, and you come with having a reputation for doing things your way. You're Maverick.
That also and sounds like stuck. A perfect fit. Yeah.
Yeah, and it stuck. I was Officer Maverick, and then when I got promoted, I was Sergeant Maverick, and it kind of became my alter ego. It's a lot of fun. I don't take it seriously.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, I want you to think I got, you know, we all have egos. All cops have egos. You got to have an ego to do the job, right, because you got to be in control. But we have fun with it, and then, you know, it became my nickname, the name of the podcast. It just seemed natural, and now for my son on the job, when one of the older guys, he's been on 13 years, but when one of the guys has been on 20, 25, close to 30, they go, oh, you're Maverick's kid. You know, so it's just fun.
Yeah, it's very cool. I like it.
Like I said, my alter ego. And, you know, I don't have it tattooed on me. I have another, I do in this tattoo, just in the middle of my badge, it says Maverick.
Okay.
But
I like that.
You know, that's the story, and I'm sticking to it.
No, love it. It's every good nickname has an origin story, and I like that one, and it sounds like it fit really well. Again, Bert's book is called The Real Greatest Show on Earth. You can get it on Amazon. We'll put links in the show notes. Where can people find you to hear more from you, Bert?
SergeantMaverick.com.
Okay.
I have a new website. Like I said, I'm not good with tech, so my oldest daughter's friend built the website for me. It's SGTMaverick.com. The links to the book are there. My three episodes of my podcast so far, that's all I've been able to do right now. The links are there, as well as all the opinion editorials that I've done for thinkamerican.news. And, you know, it's just, it's fun doing this. And I got another podcast of my own coming up, where we talk about all those things, you know, Police, Sergeant Maverick, the podcast, Police Work, Politics, and Life.
Okay.
So I cover a variety of issues, not just cop talk, cop talk, cop talk.
Sure.
You know, so, and there's family segments. I get this last one I did, I got the wife involved because Mario got into a fight with an illegal alien that stabbed him 12 times. So I wanted to get the wife's perspective on what's it like being married to a cop. And then when she got the call that he was on his way to the hospital, no one talks about those things. So I'm trying to cover that as well as I'm going to have episodes with my own kids coming up, you know, so they can throw dad under the bus and say whatever they want, you know, being, you know, having a parent as a cop, you know.
Sure. No, love all that. Love what you're doing and we appreciate your work. And Bert Gonzalez, Maverick, Sergeant Maverick, we appreciate you giving us some time today, and go check out his book.
The honor is all mine, Jamie. Thank you very much.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.